भद्रं कर्णे पश्यन्यामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षधीर्यचत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसश्चनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Seventh verse of the Upanishad, Nanta Prajnam.
Page 34.
Nanta pregnam, nabahish pregnam, no bayatap pregnam, na pregnam, adrishtam. Avyavaharyam, agrahyam, alakshanam, achintyam, avyapadeshyam, ekatma pratyayasaram, prapancho prashamam, shantam, Shivam, Advaitam, Chaturtam Manyante, Saatma, Savikneyaha. This Nantapragnam is the fourth pada called Turiya. We've already done Vishwa, the waking state. Right? Vishwa and Vaishvanara. Vishwa, the waking state, and Virat, I mean Virat and Vishwa. Virat is the whole waking state, and Vishwa is the waker, Vishwa Vaishvanara. We've done the Tejasa, the dreamer. We've done Prajna, the deep sleeper. So these are the first three padas. Right? And now there's the Chatushpada, the Chaturta, the fourth pada, called Turiya. So here's what Turiya is. Na'antav-pregnyaha. That one, so see, we'll work our way through. Na'antav-pregnyaha. The one who is not conscious, na. The na'antav-pregnyaha. That Turiya, that fourth pada, is not conscious of anything inside. Tejasa. Tejasa is conscious of the dream state. Turiya, fourth pada, is not conscious of anything inside. So we could say is not conscious of the dream state. Okay. So the Turiya, the fourth, is not conscious of the dream state. I think it's on page 35 or something. You found it? Okay. Oh, she got a different one. Okay. Not only not conscious of what is inside, na bahishpregnya, not conscious of what is outside. Right? In the waking state, you're conscious of what is outside, what you experience through your sense perceptions. In what we call the dream state, it's whatever we're conscious of that is not generated by sense perception. So Turiya, this fourth state, is not conscious of the waking state and is not conscious of the dream state. So he takes the dream state first for some reason. Not conscious of any internal experience, anta, na antapragna, na bahish. Bahish means outside. Not conscious of any external experience generated through sense perception. So now the first two padas are eliminated, are different. So turiya, the fourth, is different than vishwa. Vishwa is the one who's conscious of the waking state. Tajasa is the one who's conscious of the dream state. This fourth pada is not conscious of the waking state or of the dream state. Okay. So, na antav pragnam, na behish pragnam, na ubayatav pragnam, nor is this fourth pada conscious of any state. Ubayatav means not conscious of either state, the waking state or the dream state, and is not in some liminal position abiding in between the two. It's not that either. It's not like there's a waking state and a dream state, but then there's this intermediary space. Maybe there's some sort of intermediary space between the waking state and the dream state that the turiya could be conscious of. No. Not in between either. Ubayatav, so na, ubaya means both. So not conscious of both. But say there's a waking state over here, and there's something changing into a dream state, and here in this middle position, there's consciousness which is aware of that and extending to both. No. It's not this, it's not this, it's not anything in between the waking and the dream. No type of liminal state. Conscious, not conscious of that. Na prajnanaganam. Nor is it a massive consciousness. Now, prajnanagana is the term that's used for the deep sleep state. And why they say prajnanagana means like a mass, a gana, a massive consciousness. How they're looking at that? They're looking at that consciousness from the standpoint of the upadi. For instance, in the waking state, I see that this is external consciousness generated by my sense perception. You just look at the waking state as consciousness of what is external. Another way of translating it, external consciousness. You look at the dream state as internal consciousness, because what you're perceiving is not at all away from consciousness. So you might have said, this is external consciousness. The dream state is internal consciousness. In the deep sleep state, what happens is all of the diversity of external consciousness and the diversity of internal consciousness have all kind of collapsed together into a big mass, in the sense that in the deep sleep, there's no differentiation, right? So you have external consciousness, internal consciousness, and then in the deep sleep state, there's no diversity at all, so it's just a mass of consciousness. It's as though all of this manifestation has come into its causal condition. And so it's just abiding there as an undifferentiated mass. So it's an undifferentiated mass of consciousness. That's what they call prajnanagana. Okay? It's not that either. It's not prajnanagana either. Because the mass of consciousness has to do with the withdrawal of these effects of the waking state and the dream state into their causal condition, so there's no diversity, and now you just have a mass, which is the karana, which is causal, to the waking state and the dream state. Why? Because it's out of that causal condition where there's total, where all differentiation has gone into its unmanifest condition, that the same manifest world comes. In other words, you, the waker, go into an unmanifest condition in the deep sleep, but it's the same waker that comes back, right? It's your dream comes to an end, but your memory of the dream comes back. Actually, in terms of our experience, the one who's doing all of the analysis is the waker, in terms of this, in terms of how we're talking now. Let me just make this clear. When we're analyzing all of this, we are in the waking state. The waker is talking about the dreamer and the deep sleeper. It's possible for you to have a dream where Vedanta is being taught in the dream, you know. But that teaching is between the dream guru and the dream student. Right? And when you wake up from that dream, the dream student and the dream, the dream student and the dream teacher are no longer there to be analyzing, it. See what I mean? So for us, teaching is taking place in this waking state. And so we look at the anuvritti, or the continuation of my own presence in the dream state and in the deep sleep state, where I can say that I slept last night, and when I was asleep, all of this diversity was in unmanifest condition, including the differentiation and the diversity of the waker. All of it was in unmanifest condition. But now I'm back. I went into unmanifest condition experientially. Don't say like this, well, you know, the body was still there breathing and all of this, so I was still there. But we're not talking on that level. We're talking on the level of your experience. In the waking state, you are experiencing this bahishpragna. You're just experiencing this external world. In the dream state, the experience of the external world and even the physical body, which is perceived by your sense organs, this experience isn't there. So the dream experience negates the waking experience. Right? When you have the dream experience, this experience doesn't exist. When you have the deep sleep experience, the dream experience and the waking experience aren't there. Right? There's just that prajnanagana. So we have to look, when we're trying to discern or differentiate what is the reality of myself or of this world, we have to look at it in terms of experience. What experience can I be without? It's very simple. What experience can I be without? Whatever experience I can be without is not intrinsic to me. It's very simple. Whatever experience I can be without is not intrinsic to me. You see how that is? If you can in any way be without any given experience, then your being is not dependent on that experience. So what is the experience of your being that's invariable? So let's just put it, and so this is all in this whole teaching, actually, it's very, very experiential. It's an analysis of the experience that you're actually having. So just think about it. In reference to your self-experience, what makes you you? Right? Most of the experiences that you have are momentary. And they come in, they're experiences that come and go and come and go and come and go. If one of those experiences were you, then you would be gone. Right? So, in order for you to stay, you know, you have to be different. You have to be different, either a different order of reality or separate in some way from the experience that goes. And so, in a sense, it's just a very kind of a simple, obvious fact. But if the simplicity of this is understood, it helps you in terms of recognizing your own nature. Because your own nature, in the end, is that which cannot be eliminated. Because if it were to be eliminated, you would be gone. Okay. So, here, what's happening is we're trying to, in reference to the waking state, dream state, deep sleep state, all of the experiences that you have, what are you left with? You know, what are you left with as we go through all of these experiences, negating them? So there's this anvaya vyatireka that the whole waking, dream, and deep sleep is. This prakriya is based on. It's anvaya vyatireka. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. And so here, if we look at turiya, this fourth, how they're starting with this, how they're starting with it, is just looking at your experience. This fourth pada, is not Ahish Prajna. It's not the waking state. That's what it's saying. Not Bahish Prajna. It's not the waking state. It's not external consciousness. It's not the dream state, right? Antah Prajna. It's not the dream state either. It's also not consciousness of something in between. So it's not waking consciousness. It's not dream consciousness. It's not consciousness between the two. It's also not an undifferentiated mass of consciousness. It means talking about the deep sleep state when the waking state and the dream state are not there, are in a causal condition. It's not that either, when he says. Nor is it prajnam, your prajnam means, nor is it consciousness of everything. Like say there was a consciousness of the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state, the whole universe, just one consciousness of the whole thing. It's not that either. We say Ishvara, the whole Maya Upadi, is known. That's Ishvara. But Turiya, the fourth, is not consciousness that is a knower of the whole. It's not conscious of the whole, of everything all at once. So na prajnam. Nor is it aprajnam, not aprajnam. Nor is it unconscious. Nor is it inert. So prajnam means that which is conscious of everything. Aprajnam means conscious of nothing, inert. It's not inert either. Okay? Not aprajnam. Okay? So now we have just negated all possible, we've negated basically all objectified experience. See that? You've negated all possibilities of objectified experience. So that is, and we're not done yet, but that is what we call a complete neti-neti. Not this, not this, not this. We've gotten rid of everything. So now, still with this negative, having gotten rid of the whole creation on every level, of every possible type of knowership, or every type of manifestation of consciousness, within duality, we say now it is this turiya, this fourth state, is adrishtam. It is not something which can be seen. Drishta means that which can be seen. Adrishta, it can't be seen. This turiya, this fourth state, cannot be seen. Means it can't be objectified. I can't witness it with my sensory means. It's adrishtam. It's not subject to objectification. Drishtam means to be seen. Adrishtam, it can't be seen. It's avyavaharyam. Vyavahara means vyavahara is how I can engage in the world. It's engagement in activity in the world. That's vyavahara. This is avyavaharyam. It can't engage in any type of relationship or business activity in the world. It's not capable of that. It is agrahyam. It's not something that I can grasp. I can't grasp it. Like I can grasp this cup and say, this is a cup, and I can make use of this cup. I can't grasp turiya and say, here, bring turiya close to me. I can't grasp it. It's agrahyam. It is agrahya can also, but we already have adrishtam, but agrahya can also be used in terms of perception. I can't perceive it. But since we've all already used adrishtam, that means I can't be objectified, it can't be perceived. So grahanim means to grasp. So agrahyam, I can't get a hold of it. Now, another thing is a lakshanam. I can't infer it. Because you think, maybe I can't see it. You know, I can't see it. But I could infer it. Like, for instance, you know, if I see smoke on the hill, I can infer fire. I don't see the fire, but I can infer it by the linga, by seeing the smoke. Right? But here, you can't, this turiya, you can't infer. Because it's not objectifiable. Any type of inference, you have to be dealing in the same order of reality. And so everything within the creation, one thing can be, if it has an invariable relationship with something else, you can use that one thing to infer the other. If the presence of the one, if the presence of one thing is always associated with the presence of another thing, if I see the one thing, I can infer the other thing. See what I mean? But here, this turiya, this fourth state, is not something that can be objectified to be in the same order of reality of the other thing in order for it to be inferred. So there's no inference possible there. You need to have two things that are drishta, two things that are enjoy the same order of reality in order for inference to work. But here, this is not something that can be objectified or acted upon or grasped. And so it's alakshanam, means it's not capable of inference. Not only that, it's achintyam. It can't be thought about. Achintyam. It can't be thought about. It can't be an object, you know. It can't be an object, a mental object. It can't be conceived as an object. How are you going to conceive it? We'll get into this as we talk about more the nature of turiya. But something that can't be objectified, it can't be inferred, it can't be seen. You know, it has no nama rupa then. It has no name and form. So in what form are you going to think about it? What are you going to say about it? If it's not objectifiable, there's certain things that words can do, you know. In the world, you know, you can describe something that that has a kriya, that has some sort of an action, that can do an action. You can describe a guna, a quality. You can describe a relationship, you know. You can describe an attribute, a guna, like a quality, a kriya, a sambandha. Sambandha means relationship. So there's certain things that words are capable of, you know, describing. So you can have cognitions of these things. You can grasp them. You can look at them. You can describe them. You can think about them. But here, can this turiya be an object of your thought? I said, no, it cannot be an object of your thought. We'll get into this a little bit more later. So it's achintyam. Then he says also, avyapadeshyam. Avyapadeshyam means it can't be described. I went and already kind of moved into that when I said, you know, it doesn't have a guna, it doesn't have any qualities or attributes, it's not subject to action, it's not subject to objectification, doesn't have any relationship, it's not subject to any kind of inference or connection with anything else. And so how are words going to describe it? Are you going to describe it by action or by quality or by vastu, by the nama rupa, by the name and form? How will you describe it? It says it's not objectifiable, so there's no way that words can describe it. So it's it's avyapadeshyam. Then it says eka atma pratyaya sadam. Sadam here can mean pramana, according to the commentary in Swamiji. Eka atma pratyaya sadam. It is the one whose pramana, whose means of knowledge, is the ekatma pratyaya. I base the meditation today around this ekatma pratyaya sadam. It is the recognition. A pratyaya is like a vritti. Right? It's a cognition. It's a recognition. It's the mind's recognition. So the pramana is the mind's recognition of the ekatma, of the one self, the one atma, the one being that is present to all vrittis. The one, the presence, the atma, the one, the ekatma, which is really the substance, the being that is present in every vritti, in every thought, in every experience. And so what I was trying to do in the meditation was to see if you could recognize the stability and non-objectifiable nature of your own self-evident presence. To see if you could recognize that you, in fact, are not doing anything. That your being is simply abiding there as all of the different thoughts and experiences come and go. As the thoughts and experiences, all of the experiences are coming and going, your presence remains stable. Your presence remains one. In other words, in any given moment of experience, there's something in that moment which is changing. Those are the vrittis, the content of the vrittis, thought modifications. They're changing. They're coming and going and coming and going. Also present in that moment of experience is something which is not changing at all. That remains the same. So that is eka. What remains the same is eka. And what is eka? What is one? Eka means one. Is the atma, is the self. So the self remains the same in every moment of experience. So you have thought, 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 coming and going. That's the diversity. There's a multiplicity of thoughts. One thought is different from the other. One perception is different from the other. So the thoughts are rising and setting, rising and setting, rising and setting. So there's a whole movement. And you can be multitasking also with different levels of thoughts coming and going. So if you just sit quietly, just to let yourself just be totally open to the experiences that you're having, there's experiences coming from many different dimensions, different types of vrittis, different types of thought modifications and feelings, all happening at the, one after another, one after another. At the same time that that is happening, there is the stability, the oneness, the changelessness of your own presence. And so you have all of the, you can use language like this, all of these vrittis are coming and going in you, in your presence. And then you notice your own presence is not coming and going. Everything is coming and going, in fact, except for you. And you're not changing at all. You're not doing anything. Now, at this moment, you can have a viveka, a recognition of that fact. I can notice right now that my being is not doing anything and not changing. That's eka atma pratyaya. Pratyaya is that cognition, that recognition on the part of the mind. That myself, which is swetta siddha, which is self-evident, swetta means self, siddha means evident. By self-evident, it's like this. This cup is now evident. It's established because of your perception of it. Your perception of it is required to validate the actual existence of this cup. Right? Nothing is required to validate my existence, the existence of the conscious being that I am, because it is self-evident. It doesn't require a pramana. It doesn't require to be objectified in order to be known. Pramana means it doesn't require a means of knowledge to establish its presence. Like to establish the presence of anything in this room, I need a means of knowledge. I said, yes, I see, you are there. But for myself, I don't require any type of means of knowledge because my nature is consciousness. It's its own light. Consciousness is its own light. So nothing need establish it. Okay? So now, in this moment, and take every moment, but any given moment, it's all always the same. The relationship is always the same. There is my presence, which is self-established, and then there's the presence of all of the different cognitions that are coming and going that require cognition, require some sort of objectification. And in the world, they require a pramana for me to for me to know you, I have to see you, etc. I can bring my memory in, and then I have a cognition of that, and that establishes that. So all of these thoughts are coming and going and coming and going, and are known. When they come into being, they are known. When they go out of being, they're not known. Come into being, they're known, they go out of being. So the knownness, they come into knownness. You can say like that, all the experiences you have come into knownness. Right? And they're bordered by not being known. Consciousness is not like that. Your presence is not like that. Your presence is stable knownness, stable consciousness. It's not coming into being or going out of being. It simply is. Now, at this moment, your mind can differentiate that fact so that you recognize at this moment what is known to you because of sense perception or because of a vritti. So you have the experience of whatever the content of the vritti is. And you also have your own experience, just the simplicity of your being, which is not dependent on a vritti, and is in fact the reason that the vritti is known. So there's the stable, the recognition of the stability of your own presence versus the coming and going of the vrittis. That recognition, right? It is that recognition that is the pratyaya, that pratyaya is the pramana for differentiating or for recognizing yourself. Eka atma pratyaya. So that recognition, the pramana is that recognition of the stability of yourself. That ekatva, that one, when they say oneness of yourself, because that self never varies. It's never a different self. It's always exactly the same one self. So in fact, this is a Mahavakya, because the self remains free from all of the experiences that come and go, and so therefore is a Sangha. It's not attached to any of the experiences that come and go. And so anything, all of the experiences that come and go, in fact, encompass my upadhi, my body, my mind, my sense organs, and the whole bahishpragna, the whole waking state, the whole dream state, the whole deep sleep state, the waker, the dreamer, the deep sleeper, all of these states are coming and going, but the atma is not. That self is not. And so once that is differentiated, there's no way to make that self undivided or two. And so what that means is that this self, which is in terms of the multiplicity of my experience, is only one, but is only also only one in the multiplicity of my experience, your experience, your experience, your experience, the experience of the universe. And the reason for that is because my being is a sangha, has no attachment to any given experience that I have. If it has no attachment to it, means those experiences can come and go without changing me one iota, then those experiences are not me. I would say like this, those experiences are not intrinsic to my being. And so say if I take every experience that is generated by the jiva upadhi, is not intrinsic to my being, and every experience that is generated by your jiva upadhi, the body, mind, sense organs, is not intrinsic to your being, then how does this jiva and this upadhi and this upadhi and this upadhi and this upadhi have anything to do or generate any type of change or distinction or differentiation in me? Which means that the conscious being that I am, is the conscious being that you are. Unless you can come up with something to make this consciousness different from your consciousness. You can't say it's the body. You can't say it's the waking state. You can't say it's the dream state. You can't stay, it's the deep sleep state, because one of these, each one of these negate each other. Each one of these states negate each other, and I'm there present to all three. So that means my being can't be contained by any one of them. And so what makes me different from you? For me, this, the conscious being, to be different from you, I have to have some attachment to the experiences that I'm having. The experiences that are coming and going in the conscious being that I am, right, have to somehow condition me in a way that makes me different from you. It has to be intrinsic to my being. And anything that I can be without is not intrinsic to my being. If that's true, then what makes me different from you? That's why they say this eka atma pratyasaram, the one for whom the pramana for whom, the means of knowledge for whom, is this pratyaya. Pratyaya means this vritti, this recognition. That's really the recognition of the one self, of the self which is one, which is advitiyam, which is one non-dual self. And what brings about this recognition, this is a lot of stuff we have to talk about in this verse, and Gaudapada will do a lot with it too. And just slowly working myself through on the first round, because there's so much in this. how to even have this pratyaya, this recognition of the ekatma, of the self which is one. It is through extensive neti-neti, not this. The negation has to do with bringing about the recognition in your experience of the changing nature of whatever can be objectified. Anything that you can objectify, that you can be aware of as an object, right, first of all, is differentiated from you by the mere act of being able to divide it into a subject-object relationship. If I can bring something into a subject-object relationship where I am aware of it, then I have just then differentiated myself from that thing. That's number one. Number two is, I've separated myself from it because I am aware of you. It's like an I-thou relationship. And on any level, any type of thought, for instance, doesn't just have to be through sense perception. If I can have a thought which I'm aware of, just that act, subject-object, differentiates me, and so now I can look at the subject and look at the object. I can become aware of me and the object that's being illumined. So I can as though draw a line between the two. But there's something even more damning than that in terms of my identification with the object. If the object can change and come and go, means I can watch a thought, for instance, that comes into my perception, comes into my experience and goes, there is no possibility of me being that. Because I can be without it, I still am, and that is gone. If that, whatever it was intrinsic to my being, then I can't be without it, because it is me. But if I can be without it, then that's not what's intrinsic to me. And so this viveka with the Mandukya Upanishad, what it's doing is making you look at this in reference to the totality of your experience divided into the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. Because this covers the gamut of my experience. I can go into each state and look at the subject-object relationship, but then I can go from the waking state to the dream state to the deep sleep state and notice that each state negates the other. And it negates the other completely. So that in the waking experience, I am a waker. There's a subject-object. Say we take the waking state. There is a waking body-mind-sense organs in a waking world. Right? I, this body, mind, sense organs, am experiencing the world through my sense organs. That's the waking state. But in the dream state, I have a different body experiencing a different world with another set of sense organs, right? And so when you look at what the dream state negates, the waking state, it doesn't just negate the waking state, it negates the knower in the waking state. But in the waking state, this body, mind, sense organs is the knower. Well, this body, mind, sense organs that I take to be me in the waking state is not there in the dream state. Another body, mind, sense organs in a subtle realm, subtle in the dream world is there. Now, that means that I have two bodies. I have this waking state body and this dream state body. The dream state body is a different body than the waking state body. And yet, I am, right, the self of the waker and the self of the dreamer. So to get to recognize who is there in both, who is there in both, you have to negate the waking world, and you have to negate everything in the waking world, everything, body, mind, sense organs, and the waking world has to go. And in the dream world, the dream state and the dream character and the knower-known relationship there, subject-object relationship there, that has to go. Who is left? The one who is left, and then you go into the deep sleep state, then all duality is gone and there is no knower. There is no subject-object relationship. That's the prajnana ghanam. That has to go also. Right? Because that prajnana ghanam, where everything's in an unmanifest condition, is different than the dream state and the waking state. But I'm the one who slept last night. I'm the one who had the dream. I am the one who's in the waking state. But I can't be any of those upadis, because those upadis, those conditioning agents, are mutually negated by the one state. You know, the waking negates the dream negates the waking, the deep sleep negates both of those. So now I have to figure out, who am I in all of this? Because I am there in all three. So when he says, who are you? Well, you are not the waking consciousness. You are not the dream consciousness. You are not the deep sleep consciousness. You are also not unconsciousness. You're not in between consciousness. You know? You're not that. You're also not the one who's conscious of the whole thing, and you're not inert either. That's not who you. So this is a tremendous neti-neti. You can't be any of these things because they all negate each other. So all of those things, the whole universe is wiped out. And wiping out the whole universe, the waking, dream, and deep sleep, then of course you are, but you are adrishtam. You're not an object to be seen. You're adrishtam. Then he goes, you're avyavaharyam. You're not running around in the dream, and you're not one running around in the waking state carrying on all these activities. You're not that either. You're not, you're agrahyam. You're not grasping things. You know, you're not able to take things, to hang on to things, to grasp things. And you're also not perceivable. You're not somebody that can be perceived by others. Also, you're agrahyam. You're alakshanam. Nobody can get to you through inference, because what's to infer? What's to infer? Infer what with what? I mean, you can only infer things that, you know, somebody in the dream state can infer something within the dream state, within the same order of reality. You know, things that are objectifiable, that have an invariable relationship, that allows for inference. Same with the waking. This doesn't exist there. Those things are all belong to the waking state and the dream state. You can't get there from the standpoint of the one who is not objectifiable in those states. So then, achintyam, how are you going to think about you? How can you be an object of thought? You don't have form. You don't have name. You're not a name. Rudi means all of the names that we have that are used to name objects in the world, the primary meaning of words. So you can't have a name like that because you're not an object in the world. You can't have kriya, you can't be described in terms of action and all of these things, or in terms of quality. So how can you even be thought about achintyam? Then avyapadeshyam, you can't be described, you're not objectifiable. Then how are you known? Ekatma pratyasaram. The pramana for you is the recognition of the invariable in all of your experience. And the invariable is not something that can be objectified. If it's something that can be objectified, it's subject to time. The invariable is your own presence, which is self-evident, swatta siddham, as consciousness, it's self-evident. So that cognition, that recognition, where the mind differentiates itself and all of its experience from the self-evident light that lights it up. The mind is lit up. It's objectified. The mind itself can say, I am lit up. I am objectified. I am continually changing. The conscious being which I enjoy never changes. The mind is recognizing and describing the recognition that it's had. Like say if I'm talking now, I say, right now at this moment, I, the conscious being that I am, is not changing, is not performing any act, is not performing any act of knowing. I simply am the very presence, the very conscious being, the me, that is changelessly present in every thought that I have. I've just used a lot of words there, right? But those words are describing a recognition on the part of the mind. Now, the recognition on the part of the mind has nothing to do with objectifying the self. The self does not need to be objectified. Yourself is the conscious being, the conscious light, because of which the mind is objectified, because of which the mind is known. That knownness is the very swarupa, the very nature of conscious being, of me. And so the mind can go on, having recognized this, it can say things like, you know, Now, as I'm talking, my being is not talking. Okay. That's my mind talking. My being, I'm not talking, but my mind is talking for me. Now that I'm talking, I'm thinking, I'm looking at you, but at the same time, me, the conscious being that I am, is not doing anything. I simply am. Seeing takes place because of my eyes. Hearing takes place because of my ears. Thinking takes place because of the mind. But if I take the ears away and the eyes away, and I take the thoughts away, take the mind away, then what happens to me? Nothing. I simply am, as I am right now. My being is not affected by the seeing or the hearing or the thinking or the grasping, you know, or the describing. Here I'm describing myself. Myself isn't going, oh, look, she's describing me. The mind is going, oh, look, she's describing me. But the me is not doing anything. So this is me, the simplicity, the wholeness of myself. Then you can say, well, is that good? is that a good thing that I'm not chattering away or that I'm not engaging in any type of activity? Well, you answer that yourself. Does your being need anything to be whole and complete? What does it need? What do you need? You yourself are the wholeness. All of these perceptions are like a dance, like fireworks in a way, an expression of this wholeness, which is itself, yourself not doing anything at all, but is completely full and complete. So just think about it. When we have our meditative practice, you know, what you do is pull away the fire. You calm down all the fireworks. You calm down all the activities just so you can be with yourself. Now, we don't do that to become incomplete. We don't meditate, let me meditate so that I can go into the depth of my incompleteness. We meditate, pull everything, this, as we'll see, this prapancha, the next one, prapancha upashamam. We bring the whole creation into a state of silence. The prapancha means the whole creation, everything. Within the five elements, the whole creation. In meditation, what do? We just quieten everything. So that we can just be, enjoy being with ourselves. That's in meditation. What do we do in deep sleep? Same thing in a sense. We bring everything into an unmanifest condition. And then I can just be me. Beautiful thing. But here what they're saying with the prapancha upashamam, that place, that turiya, is where, in fact, there is no prapancha. From the standpoint of me, I simply am. I need the upadhi. You see, in order for me to see, I need my eyes. Right? For me to experience this world of color, I need my eyes. My eyes are objectified. From the standpoint of me, I'm not seeing anything. You know? I need a mind to think. Without the mind, there's no thought. But from my standpoint, the whole prapancha is absolutely not even there. From the standpoint of consciousness, the prapancha is there from the standpoint of itself. Okay. I'm going to stop here and we'll do the rest of this verse next week because it's too much more to do. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
There's a lot of words.
A lot of words. Yeah.
What was the accept Mahabhagya?
The Tetramasi, that thou art.
In this one?
No, it's just that this itself is a Mahavakya.
This, you mean just the sutra?
No, just this Eka Atma, you know, Pratyayasaram, is a Mahavakya because it's the what they're talking about, the Mahavakya, is the recognition that there is only one self.
Yeah.
Eka Atma. Okay. And that recognition, you see, if you recognize that the Atma is differentiated from all experience, right, then there can only be one, because any experience that can come and go in the Atma is not the Atma, because the self remains. That's the Anvaya Vyatireka, the self remains as these experiences come and go. Well, any experience that you can be without and you still remain means that there's a sangha there between you and the experience. It's actually going to be satyamitya as we get into it more. But anything that you can be without you know, you are free from. And so that means that you're in the waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state, you are free from. So am I. Where's the difference between us? Because all of the upadis have been negated. Mm-hmm. You know, if all the upadis are negated as belonging to the Atma, then there's only one Atma. If I say, somehow my Atma is connected to this body, then I have to be different than you, because my self is in this form. But what if the self is not in this form? Say this body comes and goes and nothing happens to the Atma. Then this isn't me. Intrinsically.
You're saying the Mahabhakti is just that one phrase in this?
It points to that one phrase. In fact, in the Upanishads, there are many Mahavakyas. Mm-hmm. We have four that we use, one for each of the Vedas. But there are actually many Mahavakyas.
Which one was this?
Well, I was saying this Eka Atma.
Oh, okay.
Pratyaya, you know, Saram.
What does Saram mean? That?
Here it means, a lot of times it means essence. But Shankara is taking it as a pramana. Another way of saying it is that this is the sada, this is the essence of this pratyaya, of the eka atma.
Pratyaya
means like a cognition.
Recognition or perception.
Yeah. Recognition or perception. It's a perception. The reason you can even use a word like perception, which is not quite the right word to use, mm-hmm. is because the self is its own experience. The self doesn't require a mind or sense organs in order for it to be known, because it is its own life. That's what we mean by Svata Siddha. It's self-established. Does it need a pramana to establish it? You know, it's Swaprakasha means it's self-luminous. Consciousness, another way of saying it, consciousness doesn't need another consciousness to come in and illuminate. Like the sun doesn't need another sun to come in and make it shine. Let's illumine, you know, let's bring in the sun so we can see the sun. So let's bring in a consciousness, some consciousness to illumine consciousness. Consciousness is its own experience.
It's very odd that it's its own experience, because you don't need a pramana to know it's there.
You don't need a pramana to know it's there, because it is conscious being itself.
But there's nothing else like that.
No, there's nothing else like that.
But that's confusing to me. The recognition is the pramana for what, though?
Okay. That's a good question. This is two-tiered. Consciousness itself is aprocha, immediate, self-evident by its own nature, so that even without knowledge, the bottom line for you is I am, I exist. And then if I were to say, well, how do you know that? Do you see it? Do you hear it? Do you infer it? No, I just am it. Okay? I just am. I am a conscious being. But then if you were to go on and I were to press you, you would say, I am a conscious being, but I don't really know where the consciousness comes from, or if it's generated by this body. I have no idea, but I know I am a conscious being. Okay? And so, and in any kind of inner inquiry, you can always get to the bottom of the core of yourself. It's going to be, yes, I am a conscious being, not an insentient being. But then you'll question, where does the consciousness come from? It's my consciousness, like your consciousness, that we don't know.
Okay. But the mind can't objectify it, right? So it struggles with that whole...
It can't objectify it. That's why the ignorance. It can't objectify it. It just is it. But the consciousness is its own... It's saksha, or we call saksha. It's its own experience. It doesn't require a pramana for it to be. Mm-hmm. But now the thing is, so that's the state for all beings. But then we don't know who we are. And so the Upanishads view themselves as a pramana, a means of knowledge to bring the mind into the recognition of my own presence in reference to itself. Okay, so the mind, that's when I was kind of, you know, giving that little speech, talking about what my mind can say about me, you know. The mind can recognize that it is objectified. It can recognize it has a subject-object relationship with consciousness, that it is illumined, it can recognize that it continually comes and goes, that everything about it changes. It can differentiate the changing from the changeless. The self-evident me that never moves versus itself, which is continually moving. It can have that recognition. And so what the Vedanta is doing is using words to point the mind to the recognition of the self, which is self-evident. You know, so it's actually pointing to something which is beyond or not subject to duality, which itself cannot be objectified, can't be grasped, can't be thought about. But because it's self-evident, it can be pointed to so that the mind can recognize what the words are talking about. Because the self-evident me is there, and so these descriptors that are differentiating it from all of the objectified experience work. Like, well, they work because they're pointing to something that is there, even though it's not objectifiable as an object in the universe, and so can't be known in a way that we're used to knowing things. We're used to knowing things through our sense organs and through inference and presumption. All of our means of knowledge we use for knowing the universe. But the only reason this can be known is because it doesn't require a pramana to objectify it as we objectify objects in the world. It's self-lit. It's self-evident. And so the words, as they're handled in the Upanishads, can differentiate the objectified experience from the me that is the lighting up the whole thing. Because I'm there. And so the description lands on me. The words land on me because I'm there to be landed on.
So in a way, the mind has to get used to using that kind of pramana rather than our ordinary pramanas.
Yes, the pramana works in a different way because all of our pramanas are for things that are objectified.
See, it's confusing when I hearing it spoken about this way. Now, I never thought of it this way before, because then what is it really a pramana of? I know that's the question that was just asked, but because what it's pointing to is self-evident.
But it's
it doesn't
not,
need a pramana in a certain way, except that we have all these mistaken, it's self-evident, but we have all these mistaken beliefs.
That's exactly right. It's self-evident.
Yeah.
It's self-evident, but there's also ajnanam. So we say we make it this distinction. There's samanya jnanam, but no vishesha jnanam. Samanya jnanam means that all of us can say, I am, I exist. I am a conscious being. That, and all of those words, the I am, all of them are just pointing to Brahman, to the truth of my being. But I also say, but I don't know who I am. I'm a conscious being, but I don't know what that means. Is it conscious being because of the body? Do I reincarnate? What's my consciousness versus yours? So that, you don't have vishesha jnana. You don't have the particular knowledge of what this conscious being is. And so the me is self-evident, but not who the me is. And so therefore, this pramana, the means of knowledge has to come in, you know, the Upanishad pramana, and the Prakarana Granthas, all of these other works are just explications of what the Upanishads have to say. So this teaching methodology comes in and is pointing to you, taking your mind on a journey, you know, to recognizing what is objectified and what comes and goes and what doesn't. What is not objectifiable, what is self-evident, what is not coming and going. What is asanga, basically asanga, because all sangha means there's no attachment to it. It's not attached to anything, because in the end we'll see it's not attached to anything, because all of this that exists is mitya. It's kind of like a snake on a rope. It has no separate being for it to be attached to it.
It's like it's self-evident, but it's all jumbled up.
With ajnanam,
with
because
other
of ajnanam.
Stuff,
yeah.
So it gets it unjumbled, so to speak.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right.
And that's why neti-neti is the way to...
Yeah.
That's the negation is paramount, but it's not only negation. Because if you only negate and don't make a positive assertion, you know, then you're just left in kind of no man's land. But when you do all the neti-neti and then make the positive assertion, you will recognize it because everything has, you've been stripped naked, really, and then somebody, then the Upanishad said, and see who's there.
Yeah.
Ah, I'm here. And then it gives descriptors of you, the one who is left, and you say, oh, that's right. Because the words that are now being used, having stripped off all of the misassociations, are left just landing on you that is here present, self-evident. You see? So and then you have to take all of duality into account, the whole universe, Ishvara, everything. Because everything that's objectifiable, you know, is different than that which is self-evident. Everything that requires consciousness to be known is different than consciousness, right?
That's why it's hard to understand, I mean, in a way, because you're so used to dealing with objects.
Totally. But then the teaching methodology has to explain all that to you also. It doesn't not, the teaching methodology itself talks about how knowledge takes place and the difference between gaining knowledge, you know, in the subject-object relationship, which is what we're used to, and what is the difference between that and gaining knowledge of yourself, which isn't objectifiable, but which is self-evident. You know? Because just, you know, like in the tenth man story, when the old man points out, you are the tenth man, having negated the other nine boys, that tenth man doesn't discover a new self. It just recognizes that it had mistaken, it had made a mistake. So when he says, I am the tenth man, that's kind of an embarrassing moment. Because you've always been he'd always been the tenth man. And you've always been Brahman. There's never a time that you haven't been Brahman. And now you recognize, I have always been Brahman. And you know you've always been Brahman because you're changeless. But you just hadn't recognized it. Shankara, in his Adhyasa Bhasha of the Brahma Sutras, his introductory bhasha, says it's ridiculous. So it's so obvious. Once you know, it's so obvious. How is it possible? He says it's as impossible as, you know, there light and dark existing in the same place. It's impossible that this can be so, but it is so.
But the mind producing this tremendous amount of thought waves or vrittis, right?
Yeah.
Every moment.
Yeah, it's very busy.
It kind of coexists with this awareness that we're talking about.
Right.
So when we're doing the meditation, I realized how there is a certain kind of and I think it's more like the mind is trying to relax into the fact of that awareness that's always there. And how there is a certain kind of, they're like two realities, parallel realities, really. It's not like the mind just dissolves into that sense of presence, right? Because the mind just keeps going. The vrittis keep being produced.
Yeah,
even
but
with that consciousness.
Yeah, but what it recognizes, it comes into relationship with that consciousness. It's a satya mithya relationship.
Yeah.
It's still a relationship where like saying the pot comes into relationship with the clay. Well,
yeah.
Really, you know, I mean, there's not really much relationship there because there's only clay. But still, you can talk that way.
But you can't deny the pot just because you discover that there's only clay.
Yeah, and we're not denying this creation. We just recognize that it's only consciousness. You know, but say just on maybe a more ground or practical level,
yeah.
In terms of all of your experience, you know, it doesn't matter how fast your mind is racing, you're not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And at some point, that recognition becomes very clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so your being, the very simple, stable presence of your being is much more in the foreground. You know, using Gestalt language, the mind is so clear in its own recognition, you know, of itself in reference to me, that my being becomes much more in the forefront. Not that it always hasn't been, but the mind hasn't been. It's been focused on itself and on things, mm-hmm. rather than on the recognition, rather than recognition of me.
Like when we're meditating and you realize, yeah, it's really there. I mean, it's always there.
Yeah. It
gets kind of overclouded.
Yeah, because the mind's so busy about other things. But at some point, because your presence is so whole and full and doesn't, it's just complete. It's a beautiful refuge for the mind, in a sense. We can use language like that.
Well, if the mind has that refuge and has that taste for that wholeness, it still doesn't seem to stick on it. It, you know, it still
does more and more as your vairagya matures. The maturing of vairagya for all of us takes its own time. You know, we all come with certain needs, certain raga dvesha, you know, and those things work themselves out over time for every human being. It's not just for you. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, this knowledge comes. They say it's kind of like that knowledge kind of consumes like a bonfire. It consumes all of the ajnana and all of the effects of ajnana. And they use the example that, say, if you were to build a big on the beach, you build a great big bonfire, and you know you have to light it. You've got all the woods all stacked and everything. It's beautiful, huge thing. But you have to light it somewhere, so you have to light a little corner, and you have to protect that little corner until the flame grows to a certain strength. Mm-hmm. And then, once the flame grows to a certain strength, it doesn't need much protection anymore. In fact, if a wind were to come along, it wouldn't blow it out. It would just, you know, make it burn stronger, harder. Mm-hmm. And so there comes a point when the kind of the flame of your understanding just starts crunching slowly but surely through all of really the lack of vairagya. Mm-hmm. You know, I need this to be happy, and I need the universe to be like this, and I need this person to be like that, and all of this stuff. It just drops off because it's a nuisance, and it doesn't add anything to your happiness. It's not worth it. And I have to have this. No, well, I really don't have to have this, and I especially don't want the agitation that wanting to have it causes. These things, they drop off, you don't bother about it anymore. But that's just kind of a natural maturing that takes place for all of us over time. And you kind of appreciate your own, that process. And it's not very reasonable or fair to expect, you know, lifetimes of conditioning to just immediately go away. You know, your knowledge, all of the conditioning continues to present itself to your knowledge, to who you are now. So as you gain knowledge and clarity, all of your old conditionings present themselves to who you are now. Mm-hmm. And then you deal with those raga dvesha, those likes and dislikes and these things, in a different way than you used to, in a way that actually facilitates them, their transformation, transforming into a different. Yes.
Yeah. Could you say, what is a Mahavakya?
Like, that thou art. The Mahavakya, it means a great statement, but we don't translate it. The great statement, the great statements of the Upanishads. It's what is the Upanishad actually teaching? What is the crux of it? And the crux of it is that the Atma, the self that you are, is Brahman, is the self which is the truth of the whole universe. Or that the self that you are is the self of Ishwara. Ishwara means the whole manifest creation has for its truth one self, and that self you are. So the Mahavakya is what brings together the limited jiva, the identity of the self that is taken to be limited in terms of this body, mind, sense organ, so the Atma, is taken to be a limited being, the recognition that the self of this limited being is in fact the self of Ishwara. So that I can say, I am Ishwara. I mean, because the conscious being that this body is, the me that this body is the very me which Ishvara is.
I'm a little confused. That's what the word Mahavakya means?
Mahavakya means a sentence.
Yeah.
Maha comes from Mahat, a great sentence. The Mahavakya means a great sentence.
So it sounded like earlier you were saying there are four different Mahavakyas?
Yeah.
And so is this an example of one Mahavakya?
Yeah.
And this
no, they all the Mahavakyas indicate exactly the same thing. So one of them would be Tetvamasi, that thou art.
Oh, okay.
One would be Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. It's the same thing. Another is Prajnanam Brahma, consciousness is Brahman. You know,
these all seem to be positive assertions. Not
they are. They're, they're positive. Yeah. I am Atma Brahman. This Atma is Brahman.
Ekatma Pratyaya Saram is another.
Yes, but those are the four. Yeah, yes, sort of, exactly. any statement that releases the self, the individual self, that releases the Atma from its individuality, from its body, mind, sense organs, to recognize that the self that you are is the self of all beings, any statement that accomplishes that task is a Mahavakya. Like if I say, I am Brahman. I, this individual, conscious Atma, is in fact Brahman, is infinite.
So it's like a viveka with words.
It's a little bit different than that. In any Mahavakya, the limitations or the characteristics of each side of the equation that make that equation impossible have to be dropped off. Like for instance, if I say the wave is the ocean, that's an equation. The wave is the ocean. Well, one wave can't be the ocean. But if I drop off the limiting, the things that differentiate in parts that don't work, I end up with water. So the water, which is the truth of the wave, is the water, which is the truth of the ocean. So the Mahavakya is an equation where you have to give up the limiting adjuncts which cause the equation to be impossible. Like, so if I say, Tetvamasi, you are that, and I mean, you are Ishvara, you are the Lord. You say, I'm not the Lord, I'm just a little jiva here. But the Upanishad says, you are Ishvara. You say, how can that be? Well, the whole teaching prakriyas are to make you understand the truth of that, that the self that you are, that is the truth of your being, is the very self which is the truth of Ishvara. So that equation, the Mahavakya, is an equation. You know? And to understand the equation, the certain things, part of each member of the equation has to be let go. Like what if I say the jiva is Ishvara? Well, for that equation to work, I have to give up the jivatvam of the Atma and the Ishwaratvam of Brahman to be left with just one Satchitananda, one conscious being. And so the Mahavakya is the whole teaching methodology of the Upanishad is to make the student recognize the truth of the Mahavakya. So the Mahavakya is the core of all of the prakriyas, what all the prakriyas are circling around to make the student see that I am Brahman. I am Ishvara, I am the whole. Did you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
I have another question. I'm still wrestling with... So at a certain point there was a reference to it can't be seen, and you extended that to all senses.
Yeah, so it means can't be objectified by the senses.
It can't be objectified by the senses. How can it... Could you say... You know, how can it then be experienced?
Because it is its own experience as consciousness. It can't be experienced in a subject-object relationship, but consciousness is self-evident.
I guess what I'm running into is I have a belief, maybe, that All experiences through the senses.
Okay, but that's why we veer away from the word experience. If you want to limit the word experience to sense perception, you know, then we can't use experience for the Atma, because you're defining it as that which can only be known through sense perception. But the Atma, the self, because it is consciousness, is self-evident. It doesn't require self-perception to be known. It's its own light, so to speak.
And that is subject to knownness, or whatever words we can apply, when it becomes obvious when that happens.
It's obvious.
It's not something that can be reached.
Yeah, it can't
intentionally.
That's right. You can't reach it. You are it. You are it. And so there's no reaching. There's no reaching. There's no seeing. There's no looking. There's recognition.
Yes.
But you said before, which was actually clarifying for me, you said the mind can recognize the conscious awareness.
It recognizes it in reference to itself.
Yeah.
Because, see, actually, conscious awareness, whatever word you want to use for the Atma, it is already self-evident. It is already recognized from just as its own swarupa, as its own nature.
Mm-hmm.
The mind had taken that to belong to itself. And now what it recognizes is, but the mind is always changing and moody and emotional and has so many things going on, perceiving all of these things. Now that mind is able to differentiate conscious being, which is changeless and steady, the me, from itself. And it recognizes, the I is always the same. It's not changing at all. But I, the mind, am continually changing. So it's talking about the self-evident me, you know, which is its own self-established. And the mind is not away from that. The mind, it is the very self of the mind, but the self is free of the mind. The mind is dependent on conscious being for its being. But being is not dependent on the mind for anything. I think that's enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
One more.
The recognition of the conscious being is not constant and continuous. I think Edward was asking this in different words earlier. It's something that comes and goes, and eventually as it moves more and more into the foreground, it becomes...
The mind isn't always paying attention, but conscious being is always there as the very knownness that the mind is enjoying. You know, and so, because the mind is off on its own tangents, thinking about this, thinking about that, concerned about this, concerned about that, it's not necessarily paying any attention. But for a jnani who knows, with all this discernment has been done, it doesn't matter that the mind is paying attention or not paying attention. My being is still at the forefront. And I don't require the mind to pay attention to me, for me to shine. I'm not dependent on the mind. I'm dependent on the mind from talking about it or making statements about it, but not from my own presence.
So it stays in the foreground.
It stays in the foreground. You can say continuously, but don't make it into... It sounds maybe like a big deal, but it's not a big deal. It's very natural.
That's okay. I got it.
Is it more that whenever there's a need, the recognition... First.
Swamiji once said in kind of a funny way, the recognition is there between thoughts. Mm-hmm. In other words, yourself doesn't need to be recognized because it's self-evident. But the mind's noticing, not that it needs to, the self doesn't need to be noticed, but the mind's comment on it or abiding in it is just, it's like they're all between thoughts. During thoughts, but also between thoughts. Like if the mind comes home to rest, it's always landing home to rest. Those words don't work.
No, it makes sense.
Huh? It kind of makes sense a little bit? Yeah. Didn't quite work for me, but... Okay, good.